unidentified flying object.
Researcher on a mission with Dr. J. Andy Elias.
Welcome back to another episode of Researcher on a Mission. That's right, R-O-A-M, Researchers on a Mission. I am your host, Dr. J. And of course, we have another fascinating for you show for you today. Someone who I've truly been following for a very long time, a real researcher, an author, a lecturer, someone who testified at the citizen hearing and so much more. And before I introduce him, let me give you guys some news real quick. Who else will be joining us this Thursday? The Honorable Paul Hellyer, former Defense Minister of Canada, as well as the highest ranking member of the G8 countries to testify in ufology and so many other topics that are sacred to us, but of course not sacred to the mainstream media. Also, in the next 6 weeks, there's so many other guests, including astronaut Edgar Mitchell, Six Men on the Moon, Linda Moulton Howe, Richard Dolan, just to name a few. There's also Congressman Cook from the Citizen Hearing will be joining us. And for those of you out there watching the YouTube shows on repeats, just keep in mind, we may be a little slow putting them up there, but all of them will be up. The Eric Von Däniken one will be up shortly, as will every single one. If there's one that you want specifically now, reach me at drjradiolive.com and hit the contact section and I will send you the MP3. Now let's go back to today's show, because no matter what, I know we're going to run out of time. There's so many fascinating subjects within ufology that Dr. Wood can talk about. Because like I said, he's a real researcher, someone who's out in the field, someone who works with hands-on documents, for instance. He has verified so many documents with Stanton Friedman, along with his son, Ryan Wood. And that's just one of the several things we're going to get to. His latest book, I think, is a very important one, because not too many people pay attention to when we're visited by extraterrestrials. Do they carry pathogens? Because they look at, what do they look like? What do they talk like? What do they think like? What do the ships operate as? But they never really, not very many people stop and think, are we being affected by them? And that's his latest book, Alien Viruses. But without further ado, let's bring on the man himself, Dr. Robert Wood. Dr. Wood, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. J.
Oh, it is an absolute pleasure and an honor to finally speak to you on air. I don't even know where to begin, but because I mentioned the citizen hearing, you made some of the most memorable testimony there, because you were actually able to verify several documents, and one of them, which we'll get to a little bit later, the Special Operations Manual. When we asked Congressman Cook and Senator Gravel what it was that stuck out in their heads, it was the witnesses, they said, and you were one of the names that they mentioned. And I just thought that was, you did something so great for us, for the movement, for disclosure, that I have to applaud you from there. So
well,
thanks
I
again.
Really appreciate that, because I spent a little time about thinking about what are the different things I've done over the years I could really talk about that would be helpful for someone who's trying to figure out the truth. And I tended to focus on the authentication of the documents, and especially the Special Operations Manual, which actually is going to be developed further and authenticated further on my son Ryan's new website.
Well, let's go ahead and throw that website out there right now. It's majesticdocuments.com, correct?
That's the standard one that he has had for a long, long time, but there's a new one. I think the exact name, I think it has the word Special Operations Manual in it. I'm not precisely sure, and I'm not sure whether it's really online yet, but it's going to be focused on the subtle but not well known about authentication issues that effectively make this unquestionably an authentic document printed in 1957 or so.
Well, since we started with the Special Operations Manual, let's talk about that before we go on to some of the other documents that you and Ryan worked on. When I first looked at it, I just thought it blew me away, first of all. And I love the page that it literally was almost a grid of where to take, say, a crash disk, where to take an artifact, where to take a live ET, where to take a dead one. What did you think about that list? Because all of the locations on there are exact places that people have been talking about for decades.
Well, that's right. Yeah, in fact, they have Area 51 S4, printed in 1957, maybe even about 54. The earliest date on the manual is 54, but it could have been printed as late as 57. But they also talk about the Blue Lab and Building 21 in
Ohio. Was the Blue Lab in Ohio?
No, in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Ah. And of course, there was something else in Wright-Patterson, right?
Yes, there was a Blue Lab at Wright-Patterson, Building 61. Well, so, but the thing that really impressed me when I saw that table is the same thing that probably impressed you, that it was so specific and so clear on exactly defining what kind of parts, fragments, should be sent to where, that it really gave you a feeling that this is something that somebody thought about a long, long time.
Dr. Witt, if I could ask you if you could just speak up a tiny bit more. We're getting a little feedback that it's some people are having a little bit of issues hearing. But let's go back to the actual Special Operations Manual. How did you come across it?
Well, what happened was that my friend and colleague, Stan Friedman, said that he had received a fax from Don Berliner that had some pages that looked like it was a Special Operations Manual of some sort for recovering crashed saucers. Actually, the title was Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology Recovery and Disposal. And his question was, well, was I interested in trying to authenticate it? So I told him I was. I saw Don Berliner, and together we went to a photographer and got high-quality copies of each and every page. And those are the pages that I used to reconstruct the document. And the thing that was really interesting to me, though, was I talked to the public printer. I got an appointment with the guy who was the contact with the public. And it turned out that this particular person, Robert McCarter, had been employed at that time in the public printing office. And he took one look at the document. Well, he read the document for probably 5 minutes. And he put it down. He looked at me and he said, based on the content, I would say it's a fake. But based on the printing, I would say it's clearly genuine. And then he went on to say why he felt that way on the shape of the letters of the F and the G, and the fact that the Z was raised from time to time. And the point was that slightly used letters, rarely used letters, in those days on old printing press, hot lead printing press, would get a certain amount of debris underneath the slug that fell down, and so it wouldn't line up exactly with the other letters. It'd be slightly raised. And we found other examples of that in documents of the time printed by a public printer. And so this was the thing that in his mind, he said, this was printed in 1954 or 57, somewhere in there.
I'm actually glad you mentioned the Z, because that was one thing that stuck out in my head from watching your prior lectures. You actually produced an amazing documentary called The Secret, which to me was the first time I heard about the Cape Girardeau, Missouri incident from 41. But in there, you showed several documents. And of course, whether it was that documentary or it was one of your lectures, you explained what you just said about the Z and other letters that are not used very often. And clearly you can tell that they're not level. And for someone to hoax something like that would have to have such intimate knowledge of what was going on 60 years ago that I just think they wouldn't go to that level. And of course, there's that old Stanton Friedman, Philip Klass bet, where Philip Klass said they never wrote the dates that way. Find me 10 documents that they are, and I'll give you $100 for a very public one. Yeah. And of course, Stanton Friedman brought him 14. You never hear about, the fact that he paid him, even though Stanton Friedman shows the check. But anyway, to me, it was just more confirmation.
Stan and I go back a long ways.
He's truly an amazing man, and that's why I got to give you both credit, because you and him definitely go back a long ways. That's why I've been watching you for so long. What got you into this topic to begin with?
Well, it was sort of an accident. My boss, this was 1967 or so, said that he had to give a talk to the Air Force in 1 week. And the challenge was to talk about what would be the technology used to go to orbit and back 10 years from then. Did I have any ideas? So I didn't have any ideas, but I said, well, why don't you tell them how the alleged UFOs are going to do it? He said, that's a great idea. Why don't you look into that? So actually, as a result of that casual encounter, I read my first UFO book. And after 50 UFO books, I wound up telling the management that I thought there was no question but what they were clearly inhabited by aliens. And the only question was whether or not we figured out how they worked before or after our competitor Lockheed.
That's right. That's right. Because a lot of this technology was given to defense contractors. As a matter of fact, Ben Rich from Skunk Works, was that part of Lockheed, if I'm not mistaken, or was that another one of the rivals?
The point
being is obviously you have a military defense contractor who makes aircraft talking about extraterrestrial technology, which to me is just, it goes hand in hand. Of course, what's the government going to do with something like this? They're going to give it to somebody to figure out how we can gain an advantage over our enemies. Now, going back to the Special Operations Manual, what else from it stuck out in your head? To me, clearly the grid page of where taking everything was, like take the live ET with an, had an asterisk next to it. I think that was the Blue Lab, if I'm not mistaken. The dead one, S4, a full disk, one location. What else in that document itself was?
Well, the thing that impressed me was that they had sketches done of the shapes that they had found to be popular at that time. And they had a triangle shape, very much like the Belgian triangles that we're seeing later. And then they had cigar shapes as well as the regular disc shape and also a sort of an ice cream cone shape. It was on actually the page 20 of the manual, the original photographs. So there were sketches that were done by the publisher of the manual of what the shapes looked like in those days. So that was, to me, one of the most exciting things, because those were the shapes that were being reported at that time. And those are totally consistent with what the witnesses have seen over the years.
One other thing I really liked about it was the description of the extraterrestrials. And there, obviously, it didn't give so many of the descriptions you hear today, but the most common ones were in there. Do you remember offhand that maybe you can just describe to the listeners? Well,
there was one page that described the two kinds of extraterrestrial biological entities that they had recovered, and they were let me turn the page here for a second, and
I remember one was talking about the shorter beings, and one of them had the eyes consistent with I believe Eastern Asia, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, actually, the paragraphs describing the aliens, I gave to a friend of mine to do some artwork, Bill McDonald, and he took the words only, and just from those words, he drew the pictures of what they looked like. And actually, those are available on Ryan's website, and there's one that was sort of a small human, and the other one was more like a regular small gray.
Now you, Vit, were able to the reason why Stanton Friedman, which who I like to call Stan the Man, brought this to you is because of your history, not only with him, but your history of verifying documents. And as a matter of fact, you and your son Ryan have done so with several documents. Do you mind describing some of the other documents you were able to come across and that hinted or basically flat out mentioned the extraterrestrial biological entities or unidentified flying objects? What else did you come across?
Well, it was really Stan who was the trigger again. And what happened was, after I retired in 1993 from my 43 years at McDonnell Douglas, he called me up one day and said, I know you're now retired, you don't have much to do. He said, I've got a guy who lives in Big Bear Lake who has been trying to send me some documents and get me to authenticate some things. He said, but you're a lot closer to Big Bear Lake than I am. Would you go visit this fellow Tim Cooper and see what he's got? So I did, and I met him, and he pulled out document after document that had been leaked to him, given to him, sometimes given to him in the mail. And he had the original envelopes, and we became acquainted, and over the years he began to trust me as a genuine researcher, and he didn't know whether they were authentic or not. He was mystified by the impact that they had, because they were clearly telling about the covert program that we had to study the subject. the typical in the kind of things that, we got that were very exciting were the letters written by George Marshall and, FDR as a result of the Battle of L.A. in 1942 that triggered the recovery of a craft in the San Bernardino Mountains and one salvaged by the Navy at sea, according to the documents. And so this started the dialogue at the highest level in the country back then. But that was just one kind of document. Other documents talked about details of what we found at Roswell. For example, it identified the four Sandia Engineering District personnel who died as a result of apparently handling the alien body. This is one of the examples that's in my book, Alien Viruses, of where apparently people have been killed. So the kind of material that Timothy Cooper had accumulated and was accumulating even as I continued to be friendly with him was enormously large. It had thousands of pages. One day he said that somebody came to his door with a whole armful of stuff, and it was clearly the results of the contents of a file that he had. And it had some top secret material along with some totally unclassified material about the Soviet Union's army plans, you know. So these thousands of pages of documents he gave to me after he lost interest in the subject, and he clearly knew that I was a researcher who was going to try to do something with it.
Well, so you have done something with it. That's the fascinating part.
Yeah. Well, the way to approach the authentication issue, of course, if you've got some that are on original paper, it's a lot. You're able to do it with more confidence than if it's just copies. But most of them were just copies, but a few of them were on original paper. And totally, I'd say there's at least 1,000 pages, and of those pages, maybe 500 of them are classified secret or top secret.
And I remember, this might have been from the documentary that you and Ryan produced. I'm going to throw it out there again. It's called The Secret, which to me I thought was one of the best documentaries on this topic ever made. Ryan was describing one of the original documents. I believe he said onion skin was what it was made of, the actual paper,
yes.
Which...
Yes, that's right.
And you're able to go on. I was going to say you're able to verify that much more because with confidence because of the fact that it's a real document as opposed to a photograph of an original document.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When you have the original, why you can do things like try to get confirm that the watermark on the paper is consistent with the paper that would have been used at that time. And even though it was still a carbon copy, so we don't have the image of the original typewriter impression. Nevertheless, you can do a pretty good job and try to match the type font.
Same thing with the inks, right?
And you can take a piece of ink, and there's a procedure where you take about a 1 millimeter diameter of pieces of the paper out, including the ink, and then you can go to a professional who will be able to analyze the ink and compare it with inks that were in use at that time, so they can date. In effect, they can date the ink.
Now, I obviously earlier in those years, there was a paper trail. And these days, I think because of maybe leaks or maybe because it was on purpose, obviously some white hat out there was sending things to Mr. Cooper. I don't know what they do nowadays. Maybe they just keep it in a digital database rather than typing a letter in a I honestly, we could only speculate on that. But why Tim Cooper, do you know why? Did he have any access to someone up there, access to a white hat who wanted this information out? Or what? I mean, this is pure speculation.
Well, what he told me was that it all was linked to his father. His father was in the Air Force, I think originally in the Army. He was at Holloman Air Force Base, and apparently he was the guy responsible for a reproductive facility. It was a little building all by itself. And Tim told me that his father one day was visited by a couple of guys an officer and a couple of guys with machine guns, telling him to send everybody else home. He had a job for him. So he was told to print this document overnight. And he did. He did all the parts necessary to make it happen, and printed the copies and gave them to him, but the document was a recovery of a crashed saucer. And so that was what, when he told his son that, that was one of the things that, you know, got Tim's interest. And that, I think, is the reason, because the people he knew in that process, his father knew, were probably, very likely, in my opinion, the ones who thought that Tim Cooper was somebody they could select to leak documents to if they were whistleblowers and wanted to get this word out.
Well, we are all glad they did, because if Tim didn't get them, you wouldn't have been able to authenticate them and bring them to the world. And I think it's documents like that that provide so much more proof than a photograph these days, because so many people can say the photograph was photoshopped, manipulated. That's why you and Ryan took such a different approach. Now, going to the actual crash retrievals, I'm so glad you mentioned the Battle of L.A., because before, when I was younger, back in the 80s, I used to only think that the two crashes were Roswell and Kecksburg. And then, of course, as I immersed myself more and more into this topic, I started realizing that there was so many more. Allegedly, there was one in 2008 in Needles, California, going back to before Roswell, of course, the Cape Girardeau 1941 incident, which you talked about in your movie. As you mentioned, the Battle of Los Angeles, 1942, which I love what the government says as an explanation. Wartime jitters. Yeah, right. We fired 1,200 aircraft rounds in the sky, anti-aircraft, and killed six citizens because we were shooting at nothing. It just makes no sense. And then they have the photograph on the cover of LA Times. I mean, to me, it was just ludicrous. But then, of course, you have all those incidents in between. Can you tell us about the Cape Girardeau incident? Because to me, it was your documentary that opened my eyes to it.
Well, apparently what happened was that the vehicle crashed, and the minister who lived in Cape Girardeau got a call to come to the crash site because there were dead aliens, and he was asked to bless the bodies. And there was apparently a photograph taken of a couple of dead aliens, well, one dead alien being held up, anyway, by two FBI guys. And this photograph was seen by the minister, of course, and his wife and his daughter, and we interviewed his granddaughter, who had not seen the photograph, but she had heard her mother talk about it. And so this was sort of the closest we could come to a physical link. But the story was that he had indeed come to bless the bodies. And everybody in the family knew what the story was.
And it was Charlotte Mann, that was who you interviewed, the granddaughter of the minister.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
And I feel so bad. I just can imagine being the minister. The poor guy hears of a crash, thinking it's an aircraft, and he goes to administer last rites, realizes it's not humans, but still, being a man of the cloth, he decides to administer the last rites. And then to be surrounded and forcefully taken by the government agents, I think that would just be rather wrong to treat anybody that way, let alone a minister. So that's one of the reasons why that story really stuck out in my head, not to mention that it happened during World War II. Granted, it was before we had entered the army. The United States had entered the European front. Nonetheless, battles were still, you know, going on with Hitler and in the eastern side of the world. Do you know anything about crash and retrievals outside of the continental United States?
Well, the best summary of the crash retrievals throughout the world, I think, is in my son's book, Magic Eyes Only, where he talks about more than 70 different individual crashes.
I feel like if you want to break boundaries, you need to be yourself.
Breaking boundaries and stereotypes.
Don't let anyone stop you from doing what you want to do.
Doing what they love to do and actually going for it.
If you love something, you should do it, and you should never stop.
Of which I think about a third of them are outside. But the one that is featured in my book, The Alien Viruses, is the Chihuahua crash of 74, I think, where we were tracking an airplane and the UFO, and they apparently collided. The plane crashed, and the Mexican authorities went to recover it, but that our CIA was watching everything, of course, and they were unable to get approval to go but they went anyway, and they flew over the crash, and it turned out that they saw a Mexican convoy with dead Mexicans lying beside the convoy, and so they landed, and sure enough, it turned out that they had been killed by some unknown problem, and they took the craft, and they actually sent it to Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, as I understand it. So this is one of the classic cases of apparently death by alien virus.
When I first heard about that case, and I remember your son Ryan on History Channel, specifically the program I think was Mexico's Roswell, and the way he described that when we, United States, offered the Mexican authorities assistance for the retrieval of this, they denied us. And of course, we went anyway, just as you mentioned. But the way Ryan said it, I will never forget these words. He said, we've done this before because of the uniformity they've acted in, which showed to me that obviously there has to be teams ready globally to execute such a mission, because you can't.
Right. That's very, very important that you asked about the Cape Girardeau case, because I think this is a good example of how the FBI and the Army were at the Cape Girardeau case. And they started their programs, and it was later in 42 at the Battle of L.A. that the Navy got a craft from the sea. And that's when the Navy started their program, in my judgment. And so for decades, the Army, Navy, the Air Force, the CIA, and the Energy Department, I think, had their own independent programs that have, in my judgment, not necessarily all come together even today.
I'm glad you mentioned the Energy Department, because this brings to me a very popular name, which I know you know, somebody with the Q clearance. And when I looked up Q clearance, it's only given by the Atomic Energy Commission, the highest level you can have as a citizen. And that was June Crane. You had a chance to interview him. Am I right?
Well, we had an interview with June Crane. Yes. I'm trying to remember whether we actually talked to her personally or whether we had somebody else talk to her. But yes, we had an interview with her. And she was actually a secretary at Wright-Patterson who was dealing with officers who were talking about dealing with parts of craft. And she actually, I think, as I recall, she said she touched some of the craft herself.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that specifically on that story. She said one day an officer came in and he had come from some crash, and they wouldn't say what, and he pulled out a piece of what we now call memory metal and asked her to fold it. And I thought it was just a really fascinating story. If someone is going to fabricate something, they would have to fabricate every single little detail to go along with that. And of course, you can tell the sincerity in her, especially in the latter half of her life, near the end, when she said, I'm 80 some or 90 some years old. What are they going to do me? Shoot me, put me in jail. She said, I'm ready for both.
Right.
I just thought that was a great way to just, I don't want to say this in a bad way, but sort of stick it to the government, who kind of forced her to be quiet. When you look at people in Roswell, people who were scared by being told that their family members will be picking their bones in the desert, or people disappear all the time. Very, very scary subject. You testified at the citizen hearing. All the stuff we went to, of course, I'm going to come back to the viruses, because I think that's a very, very important thing. And you were the only one that I know of that jumped ahead of the curve to talk about that. But let's go to the citizen hearing for a moment, because I thought it was so fascinating that I think we actually were able to convince you. You were able to convince you and all the witnesses. I watched the entire hearing, all 5 days remotely from home, and they came in as skeptics. And each day, every single one of the five congressmen and women and Senator Gravel gave their impressions. And you could see it literally transform to the fifth day, where unequivocally they said that we are have been visited by a non-terrestrial race, and the government has been covering it up. Now, can you tell people that didn't have a chance to watch it all, which it's available now, everybody, if you just Google a citizen hearing on disclosure, you can get the official testimony. You could rent it for a month, or you can buy it and keep it as long as you want. You testified on What was your topic? I'm assuming it was with the verification, right? The documents?
Well, I had two aspects. One was the technology, and the other was
the virus or the...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the...
That's okay. We could talk about the technology first, because I know, like I said, you stuck out in their mind where they said the quality of witnesses, and of course they gave a few names, and you were one of the names that stuck out in their mind. So something you said clearly triggered their thought process to start thinking more openly or with more of a serious approach.
Well, I basically told them the story of how I became involved very briefly, and approaching it in a logical manner. It was a technology issue. Trying to imagine what the officers would have thought if they looked at the craft in, say, 1942, or what would be going through their minds, and then replicate that in the process of starting a project that would really try to figure out how they worked. And this, I think, is what we are seeing even today, the results of. Actually, I've changed my mind in the last decade from thinking we hadn't figured it out to pretty well knowing we have figured it out. So I believe that we have craft now that work on the ET principles that are very effective, but they're highly controlled, not necessarily by our government, but by another process. And that I don't know. That would be only speculation. But in my judgment, the technology process has proceeded effectively, and we Homo sapiens have deduced some of the central principles of how these craft really work.
I would think so. After 70 plus years of them having these artifacts and ships, that they were able to figure something out. And then, of course, if you believe Philip Corso's story, there's a lot of technology. There's a boom that we've had in the last few decades that you've never seen in the history of Homo sapiens. Never in a period of 50 years have we gone through whatever change you've gone through. Let me give you one example. The listeners have probably heard this before. There was a documentary I've seen. It's called Above Top Secret, not associated with Timothy Good's book. And in there, they talked about a crash and retrieval, and there was two survivors. And one of them had died within a week. Another lasted a little bit longer. And they said it pulled out a crystal, and it essentially linked up with its mind telepathically, and it could communicate like almost like FaceTime on an iPhone today with other beings on other ships orbiting in our solar system or even on its home. Now, this to me was science fiction 25 years ago, 26 years ago when it came out. But then now you look at iPhones, and I think this is exactly what we have without the telepathy. If we were able to have the telepathic part that this story had, and this movie was, or this documentary was released now, nobody would be shaking their head. And who would have thought 25 years ago you could be in the middle of the desert, or well, it's got to be near a cell phone tower unless you have a satellite phone, but in the middle of the desert and speak to someone literally clear across the globe and see their face in real time while you're speaking to them. I just, did you fathom that growing up?
No, I certainly didn't.
This is exactly why I think we've come a long way.
You know, there is one historical story that intrigues me, though. It's a goal I'd really like to have. It's kind of a minor goal, but it turns out that the process that would have been used, of course, is to take parts of any recovered craft and to figure out what kind of parts they are. If they're electronic parts, you send somebody who's skillful in electronics. And in my judgment, they found from the Cape Girardeau crash some electronics they didn't understand, and it was sort of solid-state electronics. So they sent it to the university who had the best reputation in solid-state electronics, which was Purdue University, and gave them a classified contract to study the relationship of germanium and silicon and for 4 years. It was a secret contract. It was not top secret. But and they studied it for 4 years and turned in a report, and the amazing thing is that the people who were on the committee who regularly visited the Purdue reports for research results included Condon, who, as you know, was asked to study the UFO problem by the University of Colorado, and also the people from Bell Laboratories who were regularly there. So it's easy to speculate but difficult to prove that the invention of the transistor was actually made at the University of Purdue and given to Bell to develop commercially and for the use by the government, too. This is the way the technology starts, as Corso says. First, the government figures out how it works, then they use it for their own purposes, and then after 5 years or so, they let it be released to the public so everybody can have it. And so I think the example that you use of having an iPhone across the world,
You know, what you said about Condon, this is one thing that always bothered me about his report, aside from the fact that just there, as Stanton Friedman points out from the Blue Book special report, that there's nothing to this, and yet there's all those cases that are unidentified. But during the course of Condon's 2-year study from the University of Colorado, he made a statement along the lines of, "I've already reached my conclusion, but I'm not supposed to say it already." Do you think that was a public front, or do you think he actually genuinely knew something but was just publicly trying to discredit it? This is, again, speculation.
I think he knew something and he was publicly trying to discredit
it. I would agree. Just like the – I don't want to mispronounce the name. He was on the MJ-12, taught at Harvard, the astronomer Howard
– Don Menzel.
Menzel. That's right. I remember when Stanton Friedman was talking about Menzel, I was blown away, but that makes perfect sense. What better cover than using someone who's an astronomer at a prestigious university? Who, you know, why would he have clearances that he had unless, of course, he was working in these crazy projects? So the point being is I think that was the perfect cover of having him write all these anti-UFO books, debunking everything, but really being on the inside. Again, it just goes to show you the level that they're going to go to discredit this. I think we've come a long way. Do you think we've come a long way since, I'm going to give you three brackets, the last 25 years, the last 10 years, and then since the citizen hearing with regards to disclosure?
Oh, disclosure. Okay. I thought you were going to go to technology. Disclosure. I think that the secrecy process in this country, which started with the beginning of the Manhattan Project, has been so effective that almost nobody has a real understanding of how uniquely possible it is to keep something totally secret. And I think, you know, the idea that military intelligence is sort of a joke is not true at all. It's not an oxymoron. The ability of our government and now today MJ-12, whatever that is, to keep something secret is just almost unimaginably superb. There's the standard techniques, and then there's the less well known. The obvious thing is threats, but then they escalate so that you have to get people to their deathbed, such as Anonymous. Remember, you saw the Anonymous testimony there at the citizens' hearings, right?
That's right. Filmed by Jeremy Corbell, asked by Richard Dolan, found by Linda Moulton Howe.
Right, exactly, yeah. When you get people like Anonymous who are pretty close to death, they're going to tell the story. And the story they tell is just incredibly detailed about the sophistication of the process that we use to keep it all secret. And I think especially academia has just no comprehension of how this really works. people in this industry know, because there is a proprietary issues in how they regularly deal with secrecy. But in academia, it's just, in my judgment, so very poorly understood.
One of the things, of course, as you know, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening know this too, is the secrecy, the way they try to remain secret, is by compartmentalization. People during the Manhattan Project, some of the women that were in this documentary on the Manhattan Project said all they had to do was make sure a dial was set in a certain parameter, and if it adjusted, if the little needle was moving, then to adjust the dial. But little did they know, they were all working in conjecture to build an atomic bomb. Only later were they realized. But there's always leaks. When you have that many people involved in something, somebody's going to talk, especially when you tell them not to talk, threat or not threat. And as you mentioned, people on their deathbed clearly want to get things off their chest, especially something with so many implications. Now, I'm going to slightly change gears and ask you this. This is, again, personal question for you. I always thought, I'm like, is the reason they're hiding this from us because we can't handle it? I said, clearly I can handle it. My friends can handle it. My family can handle it. The listeners clearly can handle it. Why would they continue to keep us in the dark? And then it hit me, the technology. If we were to have their technology and we wouldn't have to use 150-year-old, internal combustion engines or anything else like that, which can really be argued is closer to 1,000 years old if you go to Chinese rockets burning chemicals, to get in the sky, then why wouldn't we have used something better? And that's the scary part to me. And do you think that's the real reason, or do you think there's something else? Again, this is pure speculation. Do you think there's something else that's why they're hiding it from us?
Well, I think the original reason for the secrecy was, in fact, the technology. They absolutely did not want the Nazis or the Soviets to get hold of this technology, and it was during the war that it became clearly important. And having started with that secrecy, it was very simple to continue it until they started to perceive the impact, as you say, on our economy in the long run. Why use an internal combustion engine if we can figure out something else? And I think we did figure out something else, and that is one of the reasons that it's still being kept secret. Now, actually, I have a friend of mine who is actually a witness who's preparing to write a book, who was working at TRW at one point, and he was studying a project to replace the internal combustion engine. I won't tell you the details or his name, but he said the project was canceled when Detroit realized that the significance would be they wouldn't need to have an internal combustion engine anymore.
You know what bothers me is, of course, the fact that all these patents that people create that would do humankind good, that are just put away in secrecy. And one step further, I've seen at least two stories, there very well could be more, of people who converted their cars to run on water. One of them, I believe, was in the States, but the one that I remember, and the reason why I truly remember, is because not only have I seen it many times, I was actually smart enough at the time to keep this on a DVD. And essentially, I believe it was in Japan. It was in that region. And this man had converted his red Hyundai, into running off water. Not like a steam engine, but essentially just using water. So he invited all sorts of media, local media, to give him a demonstration. He opened the hood and he showed him the engine. Then he took him for a drive. A week later, no one's heard from the guy. To this day, you can't find him. And it's like, I wonder what they did to him or his car or any of his notes that he took. And then I hear the same story happened within the last couple of years in the States. And then, of course, you have somebody else without a car, John Searle, who apparently found a way using Tesla technology to power his own home. And he was arrested and jailed for 6 months in London in the, I believe, 54 or 55, around that era. And for not paying his bill. They accused him of stealing from the electric company because he had found a way that didn't require using the electricity. And of course, when he came back, his lab was basically destroyed. All his notes were gone. And I just think it was really sad that they go to that level of suppression. And going back to comment on something else you mentioned, once you start the secrecy, it's very easy to keep it up. But then you also have to worry about years down the line, if you want to unravel this web of lies, how do you account for all the people that were hurt in the process, all the people that may have died for this secret? And I think that's why they might be knee deep in this worse than ever. I think, do you think it's worth, in that sense, harder for them to disclose because of how many lives and families will be proven to have been destroyed because of the secret, keeping it secret? Or do you think it's as easy as POTUS, President of the United States, going on the stand and basically saying, sorry, everybody, we've been lying for your benefit, but here's the truth now?
Well, I am told that there is a group of 12 people who regularly vote on this question. And the vote a few years ago was 6-5 to keep it secret, and now it's 7-5 to make it public. But the points you made are very good. That is a whole bunch of reasons why you want to keep it secret, and a whole bunch of reasons why it could be good to make it public. And those reasons for keeping it secret have to do with personal impact negatively on people. You know, they go to jail, or they have clearly violated the laws. And also, then there's the subliminal issues of the greater good. None of us have talked about it tonight, but there's the potential religious impact that people might feel is of huge importance to those people who are strongly religious, to try to relate several alien societies to our society and our religions. And how does that work? You know, it gets into some very subtle, interesting, and intellectually challenging questions of how you're going to solve that problem and reveal what we perceive to be the truth about these alien civilizations, where they came from, how they communicate with each other, are they time travelers or not. It's really, really so deep that one of the reasons I think that you'd argue to not disclose it is because we really don't have the answers to the key questions. That is, where are they really from? Why are they really here? And it's pretty evident, if you read the broad spectrum of literature, that one race is here to make hybrids. In fact, there's a book out, which I just finished reading, called Children of the Greys, that goes into great detail for one particular person.
You mentioned faith, and I thought this was a really fascinating point. I'm sure you know this person, Ted Peters. You know him?
Ted Peters. Yes, I do.
Yes. A few months back, maybe closer to 6 months, maybe a little longer than that, I'd interview him, and everybody out there listening, you'll get a chance soon from the archives, plus I'll bring him back. He wrote a new book, and it was essentially, because he was a director of MUFON for the state of Louisiana. He teaches in Berkeley, California. He's a Lutheran minister. And he did a study where he went and asked people of all different faiths, would you be affected, or would your faith be affected, if you were told that we have been visited by extraterrestrials? He said of all the groups, none of them said that they would be affected. In fact, they said, if anything, their strength in their faith would grow. The only group that said they would be affected were the atheists. And they said that their own faith wouldn't be affected because they don't have faith, but that the faith of the others. So those who have faith said they wouldn't be affected, but those who had no faith said the other guy's going to be affected.
Yes, I thought that was very significant, and I remember that. I think it was research similar to that was done by Victoria Alexander, too, quite a few years back. But it's very consistent. You're right. It's the atheists who feel that the faith would be affected.
It's just a matter of time. Now, of course, we have the Kepler telescope finding more and more. I think at the current count is over 5,000 Goldilocks planets. And here's the ironic thing, is they're looking at what's going to sustain just us. What do humans need to live? But they forget to realize, well, wait a second. What if some of these beings don't necessarily live like this? What if they live a lot further from their home star? What if they breathe something differently? So just by looking at such a small number of planets, you don't count everything possible. But let's take that figure of 5,000 anyway. If we've already found 5,000 planets that orbit the Goldilocks zone of their respective stars, I just can't even imagine how many more we're going to find. I think it's just a matter of time before people have to believe. I think it's the height of human arrogance for us to believe that we've always been alone. And clearly, when you were growing up, and when I was growing up later, obviously, we were both taught that there was nothing out there. Even as young as I am, when I was growing up in school, we were told there's no such thing as planets outside our solar system. We just happen to be the only one in the entire universe. And of course, any child now, any young adult was in school when they were taught, or after we found our first extraterrestrial planet. I believe it was 1996. So times have changed dramatically. And I think it's within grasp. A disclosure is finally within grasp. Do you think it's going to come by the government? Or do you think it's going to come from the people forcing the government to disclose?
I think the most likely case would be disclosure by the aliens, where the media coverage is not controllable and everybody sees what the aliens want to see. But the chances that an alien race would want to do that, you have to be evaluated too. I mean, the aliens have their own pros and cons for letting the public know, and each alien race, in my judgment, is here for their own purposes. Some of them have our purposes, our survival kind of in mind, and others of them don't. But I think that the chances that it will occur by a conscious decision on the part of the government to do a disclosure is very slim. I don't think it's going to happen.
That's what I'm starting to worry about. And I'm glad you gave that answer, because I didn't mention that third option. You're absolutely right. They can just show up and disclose themselves. And I think the more and more people who start to believe already now versus years ago, if you remember 30 years ago, anytime there was a documentary or somebody on Larry King talking about this, for every minute they spoke, somebody was countering everything they said. But only recently, in the last 5 years or so, are you able to see on mainstream networks documentaries where it's purely related to UFOs or conspiracies without any of the famous debunkers, Joe Nichols or Robert Schaefer, any of those guys, Michael Shermer, coming forth and just debunking the whole subject. So something has changed, but I'm glad you mentioned the media. The reason being is we had to rely solely on the mainstream media for all our news. But now we have this humongous influx of alternative media. People can now go out with their phones on YouTube, snap something, and before a government agent is even alerted to what just happened, this photo or video can be shown around the world. And that's what you see with a lot of famous cases. It was a few years back with something that flew over Jerusalem and then skyrocketed upwards. This was caught from several angles, several different directions. And right now, what we're doing on this network, you're not going to see on CNN. You're not going to hear this on Fox News. And if you were, it'd be censored. And this is exactly why I think we're moving in the right direction. We got a few more minutes till break. And the reason why I haven't brought up the pathogens and the viruses is because I know there's so much there, and I want to get into that when we get back into the break.
Okay.
But I do want to stay back on disclosure for a couple more minutes.
Okay.
If it was a perfect world and you were the president of the United States, how would you handle this? Because you know how many people have died in the process, and you know how many people have been jailed and threatened. What would you do if you were in Obama's position with regards to this?
Well, that's a very meaty question. I'm I think I'm entitled to think about it for 4 seconds.
No problem. No problem at all.
But no, I would basically, my reaction to handling any problem is to tell the truth unless there's some reason not to.
Yes.
It's a lot simpler world that way. And that's the way I've gone through life. And I would continue to go through life that way. But the only reason that people don't tell the truth now, if they're ethical people, is because it would hurt somebody. So I would assess, well, what would be the hurt? And in my judgment, the different ways that people could get hurt by finding out the truth are not sufficiently large to cause you to not tell the truth. I mean, the things that would be very negative about telling everything we know is that we don't know everything, is that we don't really know what the agendas are for these other societies. And then, of course, there's the embarrassment of all the unethical, illegal things that we've done since the 40s. But I'd say those you just have to lay out and let the chips fall where they may. So my plan would be to tell the public everything that I think we really know and let the public help us find the answers. You know, one of the things that my son Ryan has often pointed out is that if you have thousands of scientists working with access to the real craft and the parts, they're going to figure it out. And I think the same thing is true. If you have the entire population of the world knowing everything there is to know, they're going to figure out the answers of why are they here, where do they want, where are they from, and how does it affect our future?
I have to agree with multiple things you said. First of all, I was speaking with a great friend the other day about truth. And you first of all, I couldn't lie without feeling immoral. But most importantly, if you don't tell the truth and you lie, you have to keep up with those lies. And that's a bigger problem than just telling the truth from the beginning. And as you mentioned, if the public was to know all the information, so much more can be done versus the limited knowledge that the government has by using these compartmentalized scientists.
Right.
We got actually a question from a listener here. I'm going to try to read it directly because it came to me via a chat here. It says, are the aliens showing in the public sky without media? Will this have anything to do with holographs, smoke and mirrors?
Well, there are some people who have claimed that with our technology today, we could replicate a lot of things. And in fact, some of the technology that's reported by witnesses who have been abducted is amazing and may include holography itself. So the aliens have a lot of capability, but I think it's very unlikely that people would go to the exceptionally large amount of work necessary to create fake images.
I would agree too, because that would going so far. I mean, to create that would be sort of what Wernher von Braun used to say, that they would fake an alien invasion to scare us into whatever the next stage would be. But you're absolutely right. Why spend so many resources to fake something like that? You know, I never understood that. But again, at this point, with what's happened with our government in the last half century plus, I wouldn't be surprised at what they do. You know, it's some of the things that they're probably doing is just unimaginable. With that being said, there's everything that happened with all these wars going on, the wars that happen. It seems like every time we end one, we start another one. But with that being said, I think we should take our break. And when we return, we're going to get to the very important topic of alien pathogens and all the people that have come in contact with extraterrestrials, and several of them who have died. So with that being said, everybody stay tuned. 3 minutes, we'll be right back with Dr. Bob Wood, Dr. Robert Wood to be exact, PhD, and of course, lecturer, author, researcher, and someone who testified at the citizen hearing. This is Dr. J, be back in a few. Thank you. All right. Welcome back to hour two. We are speaking to Dr. Bob Wood. And that's right. I'm Dr. J, researcher on a mission, R-O-A-M. We've been speaking on a variety of topics. He testified at the citizen hearing on disclosure almost 2 years ago now, which is still making humongous waves. Over 1 million tweets and other social media messages have been made to the approximately 130 members of Congress that sit in the proper committees for this, and so much more. You heard about the special operations manual. We talked on a couple of crash and retrievals. This is a true researcher, someone with his son, Ryan Wood, who goes out and actually authenticates documents, looks at cases, and isn't just someone who does armchair research, which other people's label as other researchers. And of course, lectures and puts on events. A very popular event that Dr. Wood put on was the Crash and Retrieval Conference. They also created a documentary, Dr. Wood and Ryan Wood, which was The Secret, which to me was the most fascinating documentary of ufology all throughout time. To me, that was the one that opened my eyes more so than anything. And now we're going to change gears and speak on Dr. Wood's latest book, Alien Viruses. Dr. Wood, I would love for you to tell everybody, first, where they can find you in case we run out of time, where they can find you, your website, and where they can find your book as well.
Well, if you go just put in Alien Viruses in Google, it'll come up first place. So that's pretty simple.
Go on.
And so that's how you find the book, how you find the work that we've done. It's on my son's website, which is www.majesticdocuments.com. And it has high-quality PDFs of every single document that we have studied that is classified. And a few that are not classified also that are of interest. And this is thousands of pages, literally. And you can read the detailed words, which tell you exactly what was in the document. You can even begin to look at the issues of authentication of the document, because they show clearly the markings that were put on by somebody by hand years ago. So that's a wonderful resource. It's www.majesticdocuments.com. And as far as the book Alien Viruses is concerned, I think, as I say, the simplest way is to just plug in Alien Viruses. And if you get the book, I urge you to read the first 13 pages, which is the prologue and summarizes the points of the book, which have to do with the origin of the whole issue, which is War of the Worlds, of course, where everybody knows the story that we were nearly killed. Well, we were certainly very upset by the imaginary presence of a fictional invader from Mars.
But were able to fight him off.
Well, yeah. the thing that most people don't know is that the media coverage of that event was so distorted that you'd think that there were real panic and enormous confusion. It turns out that the people who really studied what happened that day, is one person died in an automobile crash, and there were a couple of heart attacks. And these were all localized to where the craft was supposed to be in New Jersey. So the media coverage, in effect, changed what was really a small event into a huge impact. And that was the basis. That huge impact of perception that aliens are a threat and we should not let the public know because there'll be panic, that was the basis of many of our secrecy decisions, in my opinion. It was the little extra thing that says, well, we shouldn't tell the public because they'll panic. And of course, that was the first book, the first story. Then the second story is Andromeda Strain, which is a fictional story of how a virus accidentally comes down from a satellite that crashes, and people start to get this virus, and it's difficult to contain. And so that's the basis of the program that we have of biological warfare that we and the Soviets and the British developed in our own local facilities is exactly dealing with this problem of how do you control an alien virus.
I'm glad you brought up War of the Worlds, because that broadcast done by, I think it was Orson Welles, by his father's book, or H.G. Wells. The point being is, to this day, they use that as an example of what would happen. They're like, look at the chaos that happened in, I think it was 36 or 38. You can correct me if those years if I'm wrong, but 38. The point being is, you just mentioned, it was just in that localized area. But there wasn't as much panic as everyone said. And I know, because I've spoken to other people who were in that era and actually heard the live broadcast, and some who took it seriously, others who were there at the beginning that heard the part that it was just a reading. But regardless, I don't think to use that justification 70 years later really is going to do us any good. 77 now at this point.
Right. The other thing I wanted to say about my book, is besides the value of reading the prologue, is the fact that it really, the content of the book is about 50% anyway, the classified leaked documents. So we show how those documents link to the crashes, possible virus issues, and it was with the specific cases, the three specific cases involved in some detail.
The lecture you gave, I believe it was at your conference, at the Crash and Retrieval Conference. I don't know if it was 2007, 2008. Maybe was it before or after that? Do you recall? How many years?
Probably the last one. Ryan started these in about 2002, and he said he was going to do this for 10 years in a row. These were really his conferences, and I was supportive. And after seven conferences, wound up having to kind of earn a living.
Yeah.
So he still owes us three more conferences, and he'd love to do it. But I think it was towards the seventh one or so that I got involved in presenting my information on alien viruses.
And when you did, I think it was the opening slide, you had a list of questions of what we should be asking, and the final question was, is do they carry any pathogens? And I think that was such an important topic that so many people overlook. They don't realize that, wait a minute, if I come across one of these beings, is something going to happen to me? And then you go through, look at throughout history, this wasn't the officer that carried the being that he found him in Vargina, passed away.
Yeah. Sure is.
Let's talk in detail about that, because obviously this goes back to the 40s, if not earlier, to some of the earliest known crash and retrievals. What got you on that topic?
Well, I think the report from the Roswell crash of the four technicians from Sandia Engineering District who handled the bodies and died. And the report of that in writing was the very, very first one that impressed me. Then there was another document a few years later that was put out called the First Annual Report that described the concerns that they had of being exposed, and the work that we had done in order to stay on top of this subject. Let me see if I can read from one of these documents.
Sure. By all means.
Says, yeah, the IPU. The most disturbing aspect of this investigation was there were other bodies found not far from landing zone one that looked as if they had been dissected as you would a frog. It is not known if Army field surgeons had performed exploratory surgery on these bodies. Animal parts were reportedly discovered inside the craft at landing zone two, but this cannot be confirmed. The team has reserved judgment on this issue, unquote. And of course, that relates to the wonderful work that Linda Moulton Howe had done with respect to the deaths and mutilation of
cattle mutilations. That's right. That's right. What other cases stick out in your mind? Because I think this is such an important topic. As I mentioned earlier, so many people overlook it, but I don't think it should be the last question people should ask themselves. It should be the first question people should ask themselves. Will I be harmed just by coming in contact? Forget the fact that it could be friendly, but will I be harmed by just being in the same vicinity or touching this being, especially if it's hurt and maybe oozing what you would call blood of whatever it is, or any of other material coming from the actual being? And I think so many people just don't pay attention to something so important.
Well, there are only three cases in the book that discuss specifically the interaction between aliens and people and their deaths. There is, of course, the Villas Boas case, where presumably this fellow was kidnapped and taken into a craft and then, in effect, encouraged to have intercourse with a female alien. And of course, that story was so bizarre at the time that people just pretty much wrote it off. But he wound up having some unexplained illnesses in the months that followed. And although he didn't die right away, he did die at a younger than average age. So that's an example of a non-death, but clearly a harm. Now, if you extrapolate to the apparently large numbers of abductions that are taking place by presumably different alien species, it's clear that the aliens have figured out that if they want to use us somehow, they want to make sure that we don't catch anything bad. So I think they have figured out what we're sensitive to or what pathogens we, affect us and control those. So I think that's why we don't have more. I think the aliens are making sure that they don't really kill us inadvertently.
I also think that could be a great reason for them to create hybrids, because they don't have what Earth would give any newborn child, the natural bacteria and other things that live inside a human body, but necessarily may not necessarily live when it's created artificially. Yeah. Via hybrid or in a tube, however each species does it. And you're absolutely right. I think over the course of the years, they've probably absolutely isolated what strains of what bacteria, viruses affect them, and figured out a way to block them, which is why I think the height or the number of people being taken and coming back and living successfully without problems is not like it used to be. And going back to that case you mentioned, I think it was Brazil, you said, right?
Brazil. Yeah.
The one that where the guy was taken on board and had to have intercourse with that female alien.
That one. Yeah, right.
Yeah, he I remember the poor guy, he must have gone through heck from all his neighbors and friends and peers telling that story. But if you flash forward to now and you tell that story, you can go to a support group and people with like-minded people would actually support you. Whereas then this guy was obviously the first probably to talk, but I don't think it was the first to happen. I would think that this would have gone much, much further back. As a matter of fact, Dr. Jacobs believes he was able to pin it down to at least 1880s, if not further. And the only reason he can't go further back than that is because he's only basing this on great grandparents and the elderly and them talking about their grandparents and their great grandparents growing up.
Yeah. I haven't followed that work, but I respect his research a lot.
Yes, yes, of course. We got to give for those pioneers, especially John Mack and of course, Bud Hopkins. They've definitely paved the way to make what used to be a very controversial subject, which still is, but is much more open now. So many people are more willing to talk about it now than they would have then. And that's why I think as a whole, ufology has moved into a positive light. Wouldn't you agree on that sense?
Well, I think it's moved into a positive light in the context that it's willing to discuss openly a lot more anomalous and unusual and weird things than ever before. I mean, for example, it's no longer a no-no to wonder whether or not the Germans might have had some technological help from aliens to make some craft that went to Antarctica. It used to be a non-interesting subject that people just poo-pooed. But the testimony of Anonymous, you heard his 15 minutes.
Yes.
But, you know, he was interviewed by Linda Moulton Howe for, I think, 7 or so 90-minute tapes. And the results of those interviews are going to be published. Well, I think some of them are on her website now, earthfiles.com. But he talks in detail about the interactions that he had with United States government people about the history of the Germans and the Navy and Admiral Byrd's experience in 1946 interacting with alien craft.
I'm glad you brought that up. There's actually two whole stories there that we could talk about if you don't mind, and then we'll go back again to the pathogens. The Admiral Byrd story, I don't know if as many people know the full story, but as you mentioned, 1946, Admiral Byrd from the U.S. Navy is sent down there with rumors that the Nazis are still there and apparently found an opening. And as a matter of fact, right now, anybody out there listening can go onto Google Earth, go scroll over at Antarctica, and you will find giant openings that you just can't see the bottom. There's actually a famous video, if you Google or go into YouTube and type in UFOs Antarctica and UFOs, you will find he gives you the actual points, the actual latitude and longitude points, and it's just fascinating. And Admiral Byrd, when he left, he had lost a lot of soldiers, a lot of Navy men that said that they were chased out by these fast-flying craft, circular or disc craft, that were able to outmaneuver him. And I just
thought, players were shot down.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And a lot of people, it's like, how can you dismiss that when you have 13 planes shot down with their crew and they're that died? You know, there's family members, obviously, who have heard that story. I'm sure the government didn't say they were shot down by, you know, flying saucers. But, you know, there's evidence right there. That didn't come out of someone's head. That happened. That clearly happened. Do you know why we haven't been back to Antarctica? Antarctica?
No, I don't. But as I say, I'm reading this nearly published book from Ron Garner, who is the guy who helped find Anonymous.
Yes.
And in this book, he has the transcripts that are Linda Moulton Howe's transcripts of exactly what Anonymous said for many hours worth of testimony. And it's a tremendous range of information about who said what to whom at the very, very high levels. A very exciting reading. I'm hoping that it will be available more completely in an easier form.
I think it's just a matter of time. And speaking of Ron, he's a good, great friend of ours, and we must wish him well. I don't know if you know, he's come down with he's sick. He's rather sick, and we're all wishing him the best. But you're absolutely right. He's the one that connected Anonymous to the mainstream researchers. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have had that tape air at the citizen hearing on disclosure. And this brings me to my next topic now. In that tape, he talks about Eisenhower, and as Anonymous was a CIA agent. I always figured, because I've read the works of Preston Dennett, I used to host a show with him a few years back. You might know him, 26 years researching for MUFON, 15 UFO books, 2 non-UFO books, and UFOs over California, because I live in California, really stands out in my heart. And he talks about the initial meeting with Eisenhower and who else was there, Albert Einstein, Howard Hughes, Bishop McIntyre, and more. And so I think he was clearly involved in the program. But then in 1961, when he's leaving office, he warns us of the beware of the military-industrial complex. I always took that to mean he was shut out of the project. And then you flash forward to what we saw at the citizen hearing, the videotape of Anonymous, who basically confirmed that story with me, where Eisenhower was cut out of the loop, and he said that if they don't give him information on what's going on at Area 51, he was going to invade that place with the army from Colorado. And that blew my mind, because that brought the story full circle.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. Just like Eisenhower.
Yes, yes, exactly.
The whole thing's so credible.
Do you think, and this is another worry of mine, and I think this could relate to what Eisenhower said. Maybe it happened a little later, but maybe it happened in his lame duck era. I'm not sure. But I am afraid we don't have the artifacts like we used to in all these military places. Why? Because they'd have to answer to the United States of America, the people, we the people. If they're in corporate hands, no Freedom of Information Act request will ever get that out there. Do you fear that we've lost, that the military has given their artifacts and disks and other things to companies such as Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and anything else along those lines?
Well, I think that's a very delicate question. I think that the large companies have been deeply involved in reverse engineering the craft, but they have been controlled also. They have been given a voice because they know so much that, in effect, they don't want... nobody wants them to tell all, and so they're under some sort of control. But the real answer to your question is, who's running the program in the world today?
Yes.
And the answer is, I don't really know, but I do think that I worry about whether the good guys or the bad guys are controlling this technology, and I simplify it that way because I don't know who the good guys and bad guys are, for sure. I mean, I used to think that the government of the United States was the good guys. And that's still a lot of true in many places. But there is some sort of a association between economic elements, political elements, governmental elements that, in effect, are controlling the use and the technology. And if I knew exactly who that was, I would be able to say more. But the question is, who are they? Actually, Ron Garner has a list in his book as to who the MJ-12 people are today. And, you know, I don't know whether the evidence is strong or weak, but they're kind of credible, and they all have links. They're not all United States citizens, and they have links to the economic world and government and political world, as well as the industrial world, and it's sort of credible. But what I don't really know is whether or not a program such as Solar Warden exists or not. Have you heard of the Solar Warden program?
I was hoping you could tell the listeners about it. I'm not as familiar with it. I should be.
Well, of course, I don't know whether it's true or not, just the thing, but presumably Solar Warden is a name of a capability that we have, which includes several kilometer-long vehicles plus many smaller craft that, are in effect, are protecting the Earth from outside invasion. They do not worry about what's going on Earth. And they're run by the Navy at the request of and the control of the United Nations. Now, that's a simplistic description of what the Solar Warden program was. And that was the relation to the non-terrestrial officers that, you remember the recent...
Gary McKinnon. Yeah, you just read my mind. That's right.
Yeah. It was the non-terrestrial officers, which was... the link to the Solar Warden program. And he hasn't revealed everything that he discovered, I don't think, you know, when he was snooping in the files. But
I agree, because he'd probably be, knock on wood, I hate to say it, but they might have made him disappear. But that poor kid was facing 70 years. I'm actually really glad they blocked his extradition, because they would have thrown him in a hole and locked him away and thrown away the key. And that just goes back to the 40s, the threats that they make to keep this secret. And this goes back again to something you just said a few moments ago, simplifying it between good versus bad and we not knowing who it is. And then going one step further, just like you mentioned earlier, first of all, Admiral McDowell, I think is his name, is one of the people that Ron Gardner outed as MJ1. But like you said, that recent vote, first it was 5-6 against releasing this, and then it changed to 7-5 in our favor. And so you're right. I think there's good and bad everywhere. I mean, no matter what you take it, there's always going to be a bad group. But what are the interests they're looking for? And Paul Hellyer really believes that it's all come down to the economics and of course the technology. And he thinks, what I'm sure you know his story, but for those out there, you'll hear him again on Thursday of how he came to this knowledge. But basically, by reading Philip Corso's book, being in the position he was as former defense minister of Canada, he was able to verify a lot of the stories in there by seeing names of generals and colonels, and he called them. And I think just that right there blew me away, because there we have somebody who's such a high level of security clearance, granted, not from the United States, but the next closest thing, the Canada.
Paul Hellyer and I are good acquaintances, and he's got a new book out, which I have ordered, but I don't have yet. But I think that tells the story that you're just alluding to.
That's right. Money Mafia is his book, and he believes for the last 20 years at least, they've had this technology to end everything we've needed. We wouldn't be needing fossil fuels, free energy. We could feed the whole world. And yet they're hiding it on purpose to keep us in check. But is that really humanity? Is that what we should be doing? I mean, logically, in your heart and in my heart and everybody who's listening, that's not the way you go about things. You don't make someone suffer so you can gain in any way. You should make everybody thrive. And I hope those white hats overcome those black hats out there, because I'm just waiting. And every year we had, first the 50-year anniversary of Roswell. We thought everything was going to come out. Then we got that, case closed in 97 with the time traveling dummies, meaning that they said, oh, you forgot your memory. Those bodies you saw were really drop test dummies that happened in the 50s. Then, of course, everyone said, oh, we're going to hear about the disclosure before 99, 2000. That came and went. 2012, same thing. It's at this point, I don't think anybody can speculate unless, the members of Majestic 12 come forward. And that goes back to the original question I asked a little over an hour ago. How do you think we would get to disclosure? And I think you're right, that it's the extraterrestrials themselves. And I think more and more people that are having contact with them is what's making things easier for everybody else, because the rate at people talking about their abductions or the rate of the contactees is much higher, because I think even though the ridicule still exists, it's not nearly as high as it was. If it is as high, people just don't treat it as such. Since you've been paying attention to this for decades, did you see the ridicule level drop?
Good question. I think definitely yes. I mean, you mentioned earlier that the critics like Shermer and all those seem to not be so visible. And that's maybe an indicator, but it now seems possible to talk about UFO sightings and not be laughed at. I belong to a bridge group, and one of the guys in my bridge group who's who hasn't studied the subject, always asking me what happened, what's latest this week on UFOs. And when I tell him, you can go to a website and find out half a dozen sightings around the world every couple of weeks, you're just kind of blown away. But the problem is that none of those skeptics really actually go to the links you give them and look at it.
Just like Stanton Friedman says, they is it proclamation without whatever it is. They make their they conclusions without evidence. They just jump to their without. And I think that's that rings so true when you look at some of the blanketed statements released by them. And I challenge anybody out there listening to speak to one of the skeptics and actually debate them on the merits. But that's for another time. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Wood right now. And of course, it's been a fascinating time we've had so far. And I, since we have a little over 25 minutes left, I wanted to see if you want to go back to continue speaking to these various topics, which I love because you've done so much research, or you want to talk a little bit more about the alien viruses.
I think I'd like to talk about a couple of other topics that we haven't talked about, the Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. I have that written, and because we got so carried away on these fascinating things, can you tell the listeners, because when I saw your lecture on that, that blew me away, because I'd known about that book from Bill Burns, and I didn't know that it was written 50 years before or longer than that. Let's go ahead and give everyone a background of it.
Okay, well, as I was talking with Tim Cooper, he was receiving documents in the mail, and personally, even as we were talking over the weeks, and one day he said, "Well, I got another package," and this package was mailed from Fort Meade. He had the original envelope, and out of the package were these. Actually, this was another set of originals, carbon copies, of this document entitled An Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers, written by Vernon Bowen. And so I didn't know who Vernon Bowen was, but there were enough hints there where he came from that I just did a simple search, and I found out that he went to his hometown back east, and turned out that Vernon Bowen's son was still alive. So I talked to his son and got his permission to publish this document. The reason it was so important and interesting was that Vernon Bowen was a guy who lived in New York, worked in New York City, and he was close to the public library. So every noon hour, up to about 1955 or so, he would go over to the public library and see what the latest was on UFOs, the flying saucers. And he just kept a running record of what was published. And from this running record, he put together his view of what was going on in the subject of UFOs. And because he was well connected with some important people, he thought, because some of it might possibly be classified, he would let his friend, who was in the Air Force, take a look at it before he published it. So he sent it, he gave it to the Air Force, and he never got it back. It was mailed back to my friend Timothy Cooper, the original one that he had mailed like 40 years later with markings that, and they'd stamped it secret or top secret or confidential, depending on the pages. And there were little notations on the pages commenting in a way that was consistent with the Air Force's studying the subject. And so I got the son's permission to go ahead and publish this with the comments. It kind of makes interesting reading, even without the Air Force's comments, just as a sort of a review of how the media treated the UFO subject over the years. So anyway, that's the background on the book, An Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers. And
I thought that was really fascinating for several reasons. First of all, it covered everything. There was a chapter virtually for everything. But most importantly, when I found out the year that he was actually alive and wrote and sent this off, that blew me away, because he was decades ahead of his time. It's like you said, he had to have been connected, because some of the information he had wouldn't be uncovered by researchers such as yourself or Stanton Friedman or Linda Moulton Howe to 20, 30, 40 years later. And so to me, to be able to compare what's happening now, what's happened 20 years ago, 10 years ago, with what he wrote, there's a massive, massive link that you can't overlook. And that's why I thought that book is so important.
Well, there was one little quotation in the book where, I forget her name now, but a famous movie person was talking about flying saucers. And
not Shirley MacLaine, right?
No. Yeah. And anyway, the notation on the margin was what is DB doing, or DM, what is DM doing? DM standing for Donald Menzel, because she was saying that there was a university professor who was publicly stating that there were aliens there. And it clearly was one of those cases where Menzel, who was cleared and was supposed to keep his mouth shut and to denigrate the topic, had let it leak to a class, as sometimes professors do, to tell him there really were aliens. So I thought that was really an exciting little footnote that some officer had written.
Especially being Menzel, who had written, I believe, 3 anti-UFO books, debunking MI.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. Professors do that because I don't know if it has anything to do with power or anything, but at least in my years of schooling, they want to remind students that they're the professor and therefore they have a little bit more knowledge. Not all of them are like that, but most of them. And I thought just that little comment alone, and by someone like that, a PhD from Harvard, astronomy professor, and of course having all these clearances, that's a perfect notation that the Air Force trying to keep a lid on this, debunking it. And this also actually reminds me, I don't want to skew off this, we can come right back to it, is G. Allen Hynek, who changed his mind after the 22 years of Project Blue Book, 47 to 69. I think it was named Sign and Grudge, and then he came on board.
Yeah.
The point being is not only did he change his mind and say, hey, there's something to this, but he also believes that the best cases were kept out of him. Was kept out of the loop. And I think that's exactly the case. That would make perfect sense. If you want to have a public front to debunk things, then don't give them the cases that involve military personnel or police officers. I'm sure if they could have got to the officer Lonnie Zamora, you know, way before he spoke, they might have been able to silence him, and that Socorro, New Mexico case from 64 would not be nearly as popular as it is now. But the point being, trying to say is, I totally go with what you're saying with what the professors do, and little details like that are what validate it so much more. And then the whole point of it being written so much earlier. What does his son think about it? What does his son think of his father's work being out in the world now?
My son?
No. Vernon's son, the one that gave you the permission.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, well, he was very reluctant to begin with to have it published. But finally, when I told him it wouldn't cost him anything and he would get some of the proceeds of the sale of the book, he said, okay, reluctantly. And we did a limited publication. I think we published 1,000 of them, something like that, and they're all sold out. And I haven't approached him again. He basically had no intellectual interest in the subject. He's a musician and kind of in the retired mode, and not interested. Not everybody's interested in the subject, no matter how stunning it is.
That's right. I agree with you. Some people just don't want to believe it. I've people in my family directly that no matter what they see, no matter who they hear it from, no matter the credibility of the person speaking, they just shut their minds out of the process. So you're right. And I think even that worries me, because if a craft was to land in front of, say, my family's house and beings were to come out, they would immediately jump to the conclusion that that's ours and those hybrids or those beings are genetically modified organisms or something along the lines of that. That's how squared-minded people are and don't think outside of the box.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah, right.
through all the years you've been actively involved, you've done so much for ufology. As I mentioned, you've lectured, you testified at the citizen hearing, you've written books, you've actually verified documents. You found the Special Operations Manual, which blew my mind away. What do you think were some of the most significant things that people will forever credit you and remember for your work as?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about that one much, but I would say the television documentary, The Secret, that you mentioned.
Yes.
Was sponsored by Joe Firmage and produced by my son and me. I think we had some of the central ideas in that television documentary, which really only lasts 44 minutes if you take out the ads, that are highlights of what's been going on. So I would say making that documentary was kind of a highlight. I think the idea that much more harm is done by skepticism than by gullibility is the one that I would want to be remembered for. Actually, I, as a result of this question I got in 1967 from my boss, where I said, well, why don't we tell them how the UFOs do it? That caused me to become familiar with that subject. And I wound up writing a paper called The Giant Discoveries of Future Science, where I took the discoveries of past science and looked at some characteristics of the discoverers, which are they were very young, and they were not a portion of the academic community that reflected this discovery they made. And then I speculated on the discoveries of the future, one of which was, of course, the confirmation of that UFOs were ETs, and another one of which is that how do we do time travel? But the point that I made in this paper, which wound up being a distinguished paper for the American Institution of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the point I made in the paper is, if you really look at it, it was the skeptics who set back the discoveries by many years, usually. And so the conclusion is that really the discoveries were more quickly made by people who were willing to be gullible than by people who were insisting on being skeptical. So that caused me to open my mind to the fact that anything is possible. Listen to what people are saying and don't throw it out until you assess, you know, what its implications are. So therefore, in this field, you know, you see lots of claims that are sometimes a priori thrown away because they're so bizarre. For example, the secret journey to Project Planet Serpo was one such claim, a book that was written about a mission that we sent with a bunch of our people years ago. And then the Solar Warden program that I alluded to. These are claims that our mainstream media certainly has not picked up on, and even the serious UFO researchers feel that they're so weird as to be unlikely to be worthwhile. So, but I think it's important to look into the evidence for them and the evidence against them and make a balanced judgment on the basis of the principles of research that we've all learned to be, that we've all tried to learn in order to determine what is the truth. And my goal, frankly, would be, if I had a goal to be remembered for, I would like to be able to write a book called The Secret History of the United States, starting about 1940 to present, and include in that secret history not only the secret history associated with UFOs, but the secret history of other secrets that are regularly suppressed by the mainstream media, which are not really under our control.
Everything from wars. I have a good friend who he doesn't talk. I can't get him to come on radio for fear of his family. has nothing to do with UFOs, the story I'm going to tell you. You listeners out there may probably heard me say this before. He served in Vietnam in 66, 69 as a SEAL. And after that, he did a couple mercenary missions, and both of them were to guard giant shipments of cocaine to the United States. And they had authority to take anybody out, you know, that would stop them on the way. And we're talking over 1,000 tons. And so that was just one of the many secrets that just so believable, because they need money to fund black ops projects. Very scary thing, but it's very true, because he's not some man that just to talk. It took me 3 years for him to even talk about his military career at all, about what he did in Vietnam. Nothing bad and, you know, major, but he's just someone that doesn't really like to talk about things. And then another 2 years to finally get the mercenary things out of him. But point being is, you're absolutely right. I think a book on the secret history of the United States going back to 1940 is a good year, because the secrecy from World War II forward is very differently than if you took it from, say, Civil War to World War I, or even Civil War leading up to World War II. I think there have been so many drastic changes. One thing you just mentioned a few minutes ago that I'd love you to comment on is time travel. And the reason I bring this up is because, as you know, from the Rendlesham Forest, Sergeant Jim Peniston no longer believes that what came there was an extraterrestrial craft, but rather human beings from the future, whether it be 300 years or 500 years or 3,000 years. We don't know, but that's what he believes. Do you think we've unlocked the ability to go back in time?
I think I'm sure I don't understand time travel and how it might work. I do know that there are seriously impressive records of relating to time travel, having nothing to do with UFOs. And there are impressive records associated with, for example, alien abductions, where the aliens, whose statements you can't necessarily believe, implied that they are involved in time travel. And one of the reasons that I don't reject it completely is that it really is awkward to figure out how they do travel fast in the speed of light without invoking some sort of time travel if they come from the distant stars. And there are there's some evidence that the reports that they come from other galaxies are in fact worth considering. And if those reports are correct, then it's a lot harder to go,
directly.
200 million years, exactly. 50 light years. So that's kind of a long answer to your hard question.
Well, I'm glad you brought it. You said one important statement about aliens lie, and I'm going to tell you this little story, which you might know. But first of all, going just to the 50s, you hear people saying that when they met extraterrestrials, they said they were coming from Venus or Mars. And then as time progressed, it was Zeta Reticuli, and then now it's anywhere. I heard a really interesting story from the late 1800s, and obviously, us humans, we like to relate whatever we see to what we know. So therefore, if 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we saw a flying saucer, you know, you called it a flying saucer because you had a saucepan or a plate, the way you describe it. Somebody in the late 1800s saw a weird object, and he thought it was a train without tracks. And so he asked the conductor, so-called conductor, where's he coming from? He said, I come from a faraway place. And he said, well, how'd you stop the way you did? And he said something along the lines of air brakes. And to me, it's like, as each era goes by, they lie more and more and more. And I'm wondering if they're doing it to protect our innocence because we're not there as far as evolution or another agenda, which goes to maybe why they actually come here, which can range from looking out for the Earth as opposed to us, or coming here for their own purposes. But I thought that was a really interesting statement that you said about them lying, because just by looking at the reports going back over the decades, the consistency is not there of where they said they've come from. Did you ever hear that story about the air brakes and the train without the trainless tracks?
Well, I've heard stories from the 1800s, but yeah, they're consistent with 1800 technology. That's right.
We have under 10 minutes left. I want to ask you what are some of your favorite or most, because we've gone through crash and retrievals. We've gone through those, the three cases in your book of the people that have passed away, the four engineers from the Roswell from Sandia, the gentleman that was abducted that had intercourse with that extraterrestrial who I just feel so sorry for what he must have gone through his life. And then, of course, the police officer from the crash in Brazil. But what other cases stick out to you, whether they be crash and retrievals to sightings to landings? What's in your that's not in your book? It's in your in any of your research that you just stick out in your head.
Well, I guess the one thing that we haven't mentioned is the fact that I have been on the board of directors for MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, for many years. And what's impressed me about that organization is exactly as you say, they start with the data. And they really do a high-quality job, in my judgment, of getting the basing the reports on the facts. They've got a show coming up, going to be released in April, called Hangar One. I don't know if you've
yes.
heard about that show, but it takes real cases and then attempts to interpret them and provide the various wide variety of reactions that the witnesses had, together with occasional attempts to get to an explanation. But MUFON doesn't have the answers. They're just trying to use the scientific method to get at what the answers might be. And so my relation with MUFON has been a positive thing in keeping me focused on the fact that in the UFO world, there's extremes of people who are willing to speculate on almost anything as possible, to people who just look at the hard facts of who said what, who saw what. And I like to work that whole spectrum from one end to the other so that we don't inadvertently throw out data just because it seems weird. But we always insist on some sort of standard of evidence that makes sense to people who need to be impressed that it's all real.
I have to agree with you there. You have to start with the data and then work your way up. And you have to look at every side of the coin and everything available to you to make that judgment. As a matter of fact, when Jan Harzan was on not too long ago, I did pose him a similar question with that. But then I also asked him, I said, do you think because more people have cameras is why more people are capturing objects? Or is it because because even without camera sightings, MUFON records them? Or do you think MUFON or more sightings are happening? And he says it's a little bit of both, but clearly the sightings being reported are up. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, according to what he said, that they're up because of the fact that more are being visited, but more so because people are more willing to talk about that. Would you agree with that statement?
I would definitely agree with that. Yeah, I think it's a lot easier to talk about it.
We are down to our last couple of minutes, and I just wanted to thank you so much, Dr. Wood. You have honestly been an inspiration for me for a very long time, as is your son, for keeping me in touch and providing me contact to get in touch with you. I've obviously followed both of your work for a long time, and I wanted to give you this chance to tell the listeners one final statement.
Well, I think that if anyone wants to find the truth about this topic, they should read one book. And I don't know which book it is, but it's a book sort of like, Rich Dolan writes, any one of his books, for instance, gives you an overall scope. Years ago, I used to offer 10 books for people to read if they were interested. But it turns out that's too many books to ask a skeptic to read. All you could do is ask it to read one. And so I would say a book like Timothy Goodwood Ray, or Richard Dolan, or Linda Moulton Howe, lots of good authors there. And yeah, you have to pay attention to the ones that are coming out.
I would have to...
Ron Garner's upcoming book, I think, is going to have some new stuff that people haven't been exposed to about whistleblowers in Area 51. Everybody knows about Area 51, and they're all expecting that sooner or later there's going to be some people telling the real story, and this may be it.
And this is why we're finally moving into that era. Dr. Wood, it's been an amazing pleasure to have you on. Everybody out there, keep up with our page, Dr. J Radio Live. You'll see the upcoming interviews, all the postings of the old ones from Eric Von Daniken to the first interview with Timothy Good to all of those will be up soon. If you want one directly, contact me. I'll get you the MP3. Join us Thursday for the Honorable Paul Hellyer. And then so many more people will be up. Just stay up to date. This is Dr. J of Rome Radio signing out.